Penguin Random House Canada presents Children of the Moon by Anthony Dessa. Read for you by Richard Clarkin, Conrad Coates, and Tabora Johnson. No longer forward nor behind, I look in hope or fear, but grateful take the good I find, the best of now and here. John Greenleaf Whittier, my psalm. One, a beautiful power. Poe. Standing in the shadow of my balcony, I look beyond the hotel grounds to where the brown mouth of the Booze River meets the Bay Raw Harbor, then out towards the open sea. I was born near the Mountain of Two Peaks. White men called it Kilimanjaro. Seraphim sits in a chair in my room and listens to my words. He is a journalist from Brazil, sent here to Beira to record my story for National Geographic. I know very little about him, except that I am comforted by the scritch-scratch of his pencil on paper and the crinkles around his eyes. My people, the Maasai, have always called that place Old Doinho Oibor, White Mountain. They say the snowy peak, Kibo, is the house where all gods live. Do you believe in God? Seraphim asks. There are no gods left. They have been driven off the mountain, if they ever were there. I turn slightly, because I am curious to see his reaction. His face is down, looking at his hand move his pencil over paper. He is 50, a solid man. His body strong and straight, his once compact frame still visible under a layer of fat. His hair, the color of warm sand, is parted on the side. Grease tames it into waves. His brown eyes are set close together and float above his small nose, made smaller by his bushy mustache. He needs a shave. Seraphim adjusts himself on the chair, the same chair he has been sitting on during this past week, ever since he arrived. He sat patiently, interviewing those I had invited to speak to him. They were mostly women and children, the men unwilling to trust an outsider and reluctant to share their stories of fear with another man. Seraphim clears his throat. He pinches the cigarette that rests in the ashtray and draws in the smoke. It comes out his nose in two streams that slow, then curl together. Is that why you are here, looking for gods? It is too late to soften the edges of my words, but I know he does not care whether I believe in God. That's not why he's here. In the past, journalists like Seraphim had traveled great distances to meet me. They talked of the bigger world and how it was hungry to hear of my work. They brought food and school supplies for the children, and so I welcomed them. They promised my story would help end the threat faced by people like me. Their letters were thin and tilted forward as if they were being pushed from behind. I call them scribblers because I once allowed myself to love a man who scribbled down his thoughts. I've startled you, Seraphim says, packing his things. I guess today's interview didn't get off to a very good start. I hear his satchel snap shut. I adjust my eyeglasses. When I turn around to lean against the balcony railing, Seraphim is already standing near the door, his bag slung across one shoulder and pressed flat against his thigh. He moves to drop his cigarette in the hallway, but catches himself, and instead bends down to douse it in a small puddle by the wall. His hands are always clean, his nails trimmed. He tucks the cigarette butt into his pocket. This man cares about the world. I can come back tomorrow or Sunday, if you like, when you have more time. If you'll allow me, that is. I catch his scent, warm clove and curing tobacco. I close my eyes and my toes clench. I loosen my shawl. Let me speak. Please, Seraphim says, and there is such urgency in his voice that I want to weep. There is nothing worse in this world than to be silenced, I say. And Seraphim's body relaxes against the door jamb, except perhaps being forgotten. Other journalists have come before him looking for facts. I have given them what they have asked, only to never hear from them again. I was left feeling used and empty. No more. I am grateful I have hunted down words over the years so that I can begin to construct a story that is my own. People tell me I was born in 1956 or close to it. I do not disagree, but it means nothing to me. This is what I know. I grew up on the grasslands of Tanganyika before the land became Tanzania. My people did not care about Europeans or the names they gave things. They drew lines wherever they wanted and claimed what wasn't theirs. The Maasai are a proud people. We kept ourselves alive. The foreigners had all heard our story.
Story?
How the god Enki sent the cattle to our people down a long rope between heaven and earth. The ocean breeze blows through my window, a distant smell of the salty monsoon sea and charcoal fires. We had been given everything, until one of us tried to demand more from Enki. He got angry and cut that rope. But you don't need to know all this. Please continue. I want to hear it. Over and over I have rehearsed how I would tell this story. But this is the first time I have heard my words. I have to push past my uncertainty. We were sent out of the garden, climbed up from a crater bounded on all sides by a steep cliff. The red dust clung to our skin. We survived the sun and dry lands for countless moons, herding our beasts along the great river they call Nile. Walking by the rim of Enki's angry gash in the earth, they also named Great Rift Valley. You see, the white man has always wanted to tell our story, to name things. The Maasai had nothing they could take. They feared us as warriors. They could not possess us and sell us to foreign lands. And for these reasons, they left us alone. I look over my balcony once again, out across the hotel grounds. Small fires are everywhere. A man has caught some pigeons and is plucking them. Some children are bathing in the stagnant water that is collected in the deep end of the pool. They do so under the bright red light that pulsates from the Coca-Cola machine. It was delivered to that spot, set up against what once was the cabana wall, shortly after the Africa Cup of Nations in 2013. They ran wires to connect that one machine. I have never seen anyone buy anything from it. It accepts nothing but South African rand. This building I live in was once called the Grand Hotel, but its rich guests haven't walked these ruined halls for years. In 1974, the Portuguese soldiers who fought the last days of the War of Independence returned to Portugal, and the hotel was left in ruins. As soon as we had taken back our land, we entered a war amongst ourselves. Another 20 years of bloodshed, but those soldiers had no need for the hotel. It is now home to over 2,000 people. There is no running water and no electricity. The city's politicians leave us alone. They know if you poke a stick into an anthill, the ants scurry about, clean up the mess, and strengthen things, as if erasing the action. With its many ghosts, we share the hotel and drink leaking rainwater. Elevator shafts have become dark throats.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?